Good morning. I guess we can begin, or?
I don't know.
Good morning. We have a colleague from Human Rights Watch that will be joining us, we hope, momentarily. My name is Bill Pace. I serve as the convener for the Coalition for the International Criminal Court, which is a global network of over 2,500 non-governmental organizations who, since 1995, had been working on international justice, the creation of a treaty to create the International Criminal Court, which is called the Rome Statute. We had 800 groups working at the time that the General Assembly convened a treaty conference in Rome in June and July of 1998. Went over 2,000 groups during the time in which the treaty was being ratified by now 122 countries. And the coalition members have decided to stay in existence to work, continuing to try and get the 70 countries that have not ratified to ratify. The only way this new system of international criminal justice will work effectively is if national governments not only cooperate with the court, but adopt the national laws and the national institutions so that they can cooperate in terms of arrest, in terms of protection of witnesses, detention issues, and also to have national legislation so that they themselves can investigate and prosecute the three international humanitarian law crimes that the court has jurisdiction over, or the treaty has jurisdiction: war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The 17th of July is the date that the governments in the United States insisted on a vote in Rome at about 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night on Friday night, the 17th of July. And it was a vote of 120 voted yes, 7 governments voted no, and 20-some governments abstained. And as I said, in 2002, the General Assembly had a special meeting in April in which I think 11 countries deposited ratifications, which took it up to 66. 60 is the highest number, I think, the international legal order requires ever for entry into force of a treaty. And the court began, and the NGOs have been continuing to work at almost all levels, at the national level, working to get countries to ratify or to adopt national legislation, national institutions, and understand this very complex and difficult issue of international justice. And, of course, many are working to assist the court in understanding these terrible crimes that are happening around the world, and insisting all organs of the court. We also have an assembly of state parties of the 122 countries, and it actually is the governing body for the court, and they're the ones who assess themselves to pay for the expenses for the court. So Richard Dicker from Human Rights Watch is now joined us, and so you lost nothing that you hadn't heard in the past. We, in previous years, had done periodic briefings, and we wanted to reestablish that and use this anniversary on Thursday as an opportunity to reconnect with the UN correspondents and the media that are covering UN issues, and bring to your attention some of the key issues relating to the International Criminal Court and the United Nations. Steve Lamoni is our head of our African work for the coalition's International Secretariat, our work with the African Union, and he oversees our legal work here in New York at the UN. There are very important issues, obviously, between the International Criminal Court and the Security Council. The treaty recognized the extraordinary power that the UN Charter has given the Security Council under Chapter 7, and so the treaty And it was very controversial, but nevertheless, the treaty acknowledged that the Security Council could either refer a situation to the court, not a case, a situation to the court, and the judges and the prosecutor and the judges would determine whether they would take it forward. And also that the Security Council could deter or could defer a trial or investigation if they determined under Chapter 7 that it was interfering with their maintenance of international peace and security. These decisions of the Council have to be renewed by a positive decision of the Council every year after if they do take it. It's not like other resolutions where they can adopt it and then it stays there until forever. So it was also a controversial relationship agreement. But we do have this afternoon discussions about the ICC and the Security Council. As you will hear and know that not too many weeks ago, the number of governments, France in particular, brought forward a resolution on referring the crimes occurring in Syria to the ICC, and 13 council members supported it, and two, Russia and China, voted against, and with veto, therefore, it was blocked. There are controversial provisions that the United States government, we think primarily because of national legislation against the ICC that was adopted during the Bush administration in 2004 and 5 and 6, but the United States puts in controversial provisions in Security Council resolutions relative to the ICC that are still having difficulties. One of those provisions about no UN financing of the ICC, even if the Council asks the International Criminal Court to assist them in maintaining international peace and security, it's restricted. And this has also been the key issue in the annual resolution that the General Assembly adopts between the ICC relationship and the court, that many governments are going to continue, I think, to push and oppose the U.S. position on this. I think you'll also hear that in many ways in the last 7 or 8 years since Condoleezza Rice and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff went to the U.S. Congress to say, please withdraw the anti-ICC legislation. We're shooting ourselves in the foot. That there has been, over these last 8 years, a significant change by the U.S. government towards the ICC and its investigations and prosecutions. But you still have the three of the permanent members, Russia, China, and the United States, that have not ratified the court. Stephen Lemony, I think, will also bring you up to date on a number of the issues that are occurring with the African Union and the Rome Statute and the ICC. And just to mention, I think I know there will be an important panel discussion this week here at the UN with the president of the court, with the president, I think, of the Assembly of State Parties and others. This is also a period where the progress on what are called the Kampala amendments, these were amendments that were adopted on the 10th, on the 7th anniversary of the entry into force of the treaty in 2010 relative to small arms and to the definition of the crime of aggression. Once 30 countries have ratified the definition of the crime of aggression amendment, then the Assembly will meet to make a determination on that jurisdiction for the court also. So there will be that session. And then around the world, there will be a number of events in China, in Cambodia, and the DRC, in Uganda. The Parliamentarians for Global Action had a meeting of Uganda, DRC, and one other country, parliamentarians on national legislation issues and national trial issues. in Peru and Central America. So there, throughout the world on the 17th will be a number of events around celebrating this. So let me ask Richard Dicker also to have some opening comments, and hopefully we'll all leave time for questions. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much, Bill. I can tell already I missed the clock that used to be in the back of 226 to tell me how long I've been going, and I apologize for being late to you and to members of the press. Honestly, I was hunting around for room 226, which just shows how long it's been since we've done one of these briefings. But that aside, I want to say, obviously, for you all who cover developments in this building or from around the world as they are reflected on in this building, it's been a sobering few months from any kind of human rights and justice perspective. And I'm thinking of the horrific events, of course, in South Sudan, in Central African Republic, more recently in Iraq, with reports of mass executions on religious lines, and of course the most recent being the violence in Gaza. And from that perspective, I want to look at a few things we've seen in this building, and particularly, but not exclusively, out of the UN Security Council, and draw some conclusions from that. One, I'm thinking of the DPRK and the ARIA meeting that the Security Council held on the Kirby Commission report detailing extensive human rights violations and crimes in North Korea, and the call that the Commission of Inquiry made to refer the situation in North Korea to the International Criminal Court. Two, the ARIA meeting that the Security Council held on the CSER report that documented some 55,000 reported executions in custody in Syria. You're all aware of the silence, unaccustomed as it is, that filled the Security Council chamber after that report, which indeed led to the Security Council vote on May 22nd, attempting to refer the situation in Syria to the ICC. And I'll come to that more in a moment, but one lesson I want to draw from the North Korea and Syria experiences here at the Council is the impact of accountability and justice having a permanent address in The Hague at the International Criminal Court. And specifically, justice is not living in tents or trailers anymore. It is now a permanent institution in the ICC. And that fact alone spurs expectations and demands for justice where mass atrocity crimes occur, through the ICC and other means. There are many obstacles, obviously, down the road to this justice being meaningful. And, of course, we've talked over the years for the need for the court itself to up its game, to get better at what its mandate requires it to do. And glad to talk about what we're seeing by way of signs of progress on that. But I do want to focus on the Syria vote as to draw attention to the second lesson. And that is among the obstacles that posed by powerful permanent members of the Security Council that are not party to the Rome Statute, specifically Russia, the United States, and the People's Republic of China. I think they merit some particular attention on the occasion of International Justice Day for their conduct in denying justice to victims, whether they be in Aleppo or outside Damascus or many other places in the world. And in particular, I think these three, who have remained outside the reach of the Rome Statute of the ICC, have shielded themselves and, through their use of veto on the council, their allies from accountability when national courts in those countries don't do the job. I think first and foremost, we see emanating from their checkered practice an imprimatur or appearance of selectivity and double standard when it comes to justice. So, yeah, justice okay for the people in Darfur, but not for the people in Syria, or justice okay for the people in Libya, but not in Gaza. That's very problematic, and I think focusing on Syria, the Russians deserve special attention here in wielding their net so many times at the council, May 22nd, to block justice for victims of crimes in both sides, on both sides in Syria, creating for themselves in the future a legacy of shame that's going to take a long time to live down in terms of Russian practice in support of justice. The Chinese went right along with them. Of course, friends of the developing world let barrel bombs drop aplenty on innocent Syrian civilians. And the United States, which ultimately, to its credit, did support the resolution on referring the ICC to referring Syria to the ICC, came late to the game, and as Bill mentioned a moment ago, insisted on imposing into the resolution a number of very offensive provisions aimed at undercutting the International Criminal Court in carrying out its duties. So I would say, with differences among them and between them, these three have something to answer for in terms of the checkered nature of justice and support for justice that emanates from this building and the Security Council. I want to end on a positive note. I'm an NGO person, and you know, I see things in a positive way. And here it is, going back to May 22nd and the vote on Syria. You had close to 70 governments supporting in one way or another that referral of the situation in Syria to the ICC. Many as co-sponsors, others not as co-sponsors, but voting in favor, in spite of the offensive provisions the resolution contained. And what I draw from that, looking to the future and the importance of that, was a break in the stranglehold over justice that those three permanent members of the council have retained for themselves in situations of mass atrocities. And I think the opportunity for all UN member states to co-sponsor resolutions calling for referral, to support those resolutions, not as council members, but as UN members upholding the charter of this institution, is a very important step towards changing that monopoly of authority those particular permanent members exercise when it comes to justice. Bottom line, this is the wave of the future because justice for these crimes is much too an important a matter to leave in the hands of a few states protecting themselves while seeking to prosecute their enemies. Thanks.
Thank you. And Stephen, before I introduce you, I forgot the ICC will have a number of very important elections, the Assembly of State Parties. They will be electing a new president of the governing body, vice presidents, bureau, which is about 20-some countries that are the kind of executive committee of the governing body in between its plenary meetings. They'll elect a new ACABQ, if you wish, the advisory committee, or I mean the committee on finances for the court. They'll be electing seven judges now, six judges plus one that did not was elected but never has served and finally resigned. And so in the judges, I might mention that there is a advisory committee on nominations that the governing body created, which is going to interview all of the candidates that are nominated and prepare a report for the assembly on the qualifications of those candidates. And this will be done in meetings the week of the 8th of September here in New York. And it is, if it works, and we think it will work, it is a very important progress of governments agreeing that judicial elections need to stop being held in the same practices of other international elections. And so I hope we can come back to you in September. We will be telling governments that we think that they should not make any vote trading, any reciprocal agreements until after they have received the report from the Advisory Committee on Nominations. The election is actually in December, so that still allows the government's plenty of time for their negotiations on the elections, et cetera. But Stephen Lamoni, as I said, is just back from Dakar, Senegal, from another meeting in Africa on the ICC. Stephen.
Thank you, Bill. So I would like to start with updates on the AU and the ICC. So towards the end of June, the African Union had its summit in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. And at that summit, the AU ministers adopted a number of legal instruments, at least over 20 instruments. One of the key instruments that has been of interest to the national community and NGOs has been the draft protocol of the African Union Court of Justice and Human Rights. Now, this protocol is very significant in the sense that you have 10 new crimes that have been adopted in addition to the three ICC crimes. I'll just highlight some of the new crimes that the ICC is not addressing that the protocol has included. These include the crimes of piracy, human trafficking, corporate and financial crimes, environmental crimes, amongst several others. Now, the key instrument that seems to be problematic between some governments and also NGOs is one article, that is Article 46bis. The previous draft protocol had mentioned that no immunity exists for heads of states or senior government officials. This was very consistent with the African Union, the ICC protocol, Article 27, which basically says that everyone is equal before the law and no one should be treated equally. And now, at the recently concluded summit, the African Union ministers adopted this protocol and amended it to include a provision that heads of state and senior government officials will not be held accountable for any crimes that have been committing while they're in power. Now, this creates a situation where you have individuals that will be exempted from the law, and what this means is that the common man and woman, if they commit these crimes, will be the ones that will be held accountable. And now, Of course, there have been a number of developments leading up to this adoption of the protocol. As a number of you will recall, that in October last year, there was an extraordinary AU summit, which was convened, and the intention, among several other things, was to withdraw from the Rome Statute of the ICC if the ICC did not recognize that heads of state should be exempted from prosecution. But the good news is that there have been three attempts at withdrawal from the ICC, but none of them have succeeded because not all African states believe that they should withdraw from the ICC, so that demonstrates support for the ICC. Of course, Richard Dicker has also mentioned the whole issue of the uneven standards of justice, which I think has been the concern of a number of African states, basically saying that they should be treated to the same standards of justice. And so moving forward, the AU, of course, has proposed a number of other issues related to immunity. The draft study that would go to the International Court of Justice to seek an advisor opinion on whether heads of state or senior government officials should be exempted from prosecution before any trial like the tribunal like the ICC. So these are some of the updates from the AU. Of course, the rest has been the same, the non-cooperation issues, but this is one of the significant developments concerning the African Union and the ICC, the issue of immunities.
And we do have Kenya that is sent to the Secretary General a number of amendments that the Assembly of State Parties Working Group on Amendments is now considering, including the immunity issue. And just to mention a couple of other issues that I think we want to discuss with you over these months is the prosecutor, when she was here a few weeks ago in her report on Sudan, indicated information that the UN entities were actually withholding information on crimes being committed. This is now, we'll be following how the Secretary General addresses this issue. And also we will hear over time whether there will be new ad hocs, special tribunals, et cetera. And I think one of the messages of the last several years is that the overwhelming majority of governments here believe that they should use the ICC since it's set up. So with that, let's take questions.
Thank you. I'm Pamela Falk from CBS News. And on behalf of the UN Correspondents Association, thank you all for returning after these years for the briefing, Mr. Pace, Mr. Lamoni, and Mr. Dicker. My question is to for all of you, but the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, has said that he is going to ready his papers tomorrow to join the ICC in order to forward a genocide claim against Israel. What do you think about Palestine joining, and where do you think it puts the peace process if you want to get bigger picture? Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Thanks for that. To put that particular query in context, we think it's important for all 80-odd UN member states that have not ratified the Rome Statute to do so, including the United States, Russian Federation, People's Republic of China. When it comes to the Palestinian Authority, I mean, we've made the point for several years since Palestine was upgraded in its status by the GA, that the Palestinian leadership ought to move forthwith to ratify the Rome Statute of the ICC for several reasons. I mean, commit themselves to the application of that statute to themselves, their own conduct, and to those in their neighborhood. We saw a few years back intense pressure put on the Palestinian leadership not to take that step. We saw that from a couple of important ICC states parties. We regarded that pressure not to ratify as shameful. And today we would call on the Palestinian leadership to get on with the business of ratifying this statute so that they are a member of the Rome system in good standing. That is, from our perspective, an imperative. And in regard to the peace process, you have to help me out here in terms of locating that peace process precisely. Because last time I checked, it had gone off the rails, the International Criminal Court not having anything to do with that. So rather than pit the ICC as a factor obstructing the peace process, frankly, I think, as is so often the case, Palestinian ratification, as well as Israeli ratification of the statute, would be a factor hastening, not delaying, peace.
And just as a follow-up in terms of his hope to bring a genocide, it would go through the normal process at the ICC?
On this basis, there are a couple of routes to go. From our perspective, the sound way to go is for Palestine to ratify the treaty. As a member, they could then take advantage of their ability to refer the situation wherever, having to do with settlements or Gaza, to the ICC prosecutor, who would then apply the Rome Statute criteria to the crimes alleged. It doesn't mean automatically anybody's going into the dock at the ICC. The prosecutor would apply the same procedures she's applying in every other situation. There is another route, of course, and that is short of ratification or prior to ratification, the Palestinian leadership accepting the authority of the ICC. That was a route they took back, I believe, in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead. And after several years, I would hope, careful consideration, the prosecutor at that time decided he could not take a decision. I think with the change in status of the of Palestine recognized by the General Assembly, that might be a different consideration made or different decision made by the prosecutor. But let me stop.
Two things on this. One is that the treaty is not retroactive, but it does go back to crimes that would have been committed if the ratifying government wishes to 1 July 2002. My understanding is a government could make it prospective. Also, it would. There's no way a government can shield parts of its own populations from that may have committed these crimes. So this applies to the nationals of a country. The jurisdiction is for nationals of a country that ratify and the territory. And so Hamas or anyone else who may have committed these crimes would be equally subject to the investigation. It's interesting also that this phenomenon of what has been called self-referral, where governments actually refer the crimes in their own territories to the ICC, had almost no anticipation in the drafting of the treaty because it was presumed governments would never refer themselves. So that this is actually the primary way that cases have come forward to the ICC in its first 12 years is quite an interesting thing. And the last point is I can remember a very senior Israeli official in Rome when they had the vote no, one of the seven no votes on July 17th. Just the depressing and astounding irony that Israel would vote no against the Never Again Court. This is, my peace organization is old enough, we remember when this process began after the Nuremberg tribunals were being closed, and it is a very serious tragedy, I think, that that you have that country opposing the ICC, and we hope, as Richard, as Human Rights Watch says, that they will see that this is, in fact, a path towards peace, not an obstacle to peace. So, yeah.
Thank you, Bill. Edith Lederer from the Associated Press. You talked about the Syria ICC vote in the Security Council, but you didn't mention anything of what happened as a result of the North Korea Area Formula meeting. What should be done about North Korea? Yeah.
Very quickly, thanks for that question, because I did omit a couple of important developments relating to North Korea. One, I think very directly as an outcome of that briefing on April 17th, that Justice Kirby gave to the council. A number of Security Council members now have begun to raise in council consultations over non-proliferation issues as relates to the DPRK human rights concerns in North Korea. And I think that is a very positive outcome that needs to get to the point wherein the council is not exclusively considering proliferation when it turns its attention to the DPRK, but also human rights issues. So that change in the content of the every 90-day consultation is one. And two, stay tuned, because this fall the third committee will look at a resolution that the European Union is drafting on the human rights situation in DPRK and accountability there. And I expect that will have some explicit recommendations to the Security Council. So this is not over by a long shot. And I think where we're having to head is towards some form of accountability, whether it's through the ICC or other means, to hold those responsible to account. Obviously, these crimes go back decades, and Bill made the point about July 2002. The ICC would only have authority over a certain number of those crimes since July 2002. But the result here needs to be an accountability mechanism for horrific crimes.
So we have a few more minutes, and yes, please.
Thank you.
Hello.
Okay. I'm George Baumgarten. I'm a correspondent both for Jewish newspapers in North America and for some African newspapers. So I'd like to ask you, therefore, the following. First, how do you answer criticisms that the ICC is obsessing itself with Africa, and some extreme holders of some extreme opinions would say to the point of ignoring indictable crimes committed in other countries? Can you go a little further on this process that would be involved with the Palestinians, and would the Israelis likewise not have the right, if they were to join or accept the authority of the ICC, the right to bring a case against the Palestinians? And connection therewith to Mr. Dicker, is it, from Human Rights Watch, you mentioned what is going on in Gaza. Would you not mean that to include what is going on in all over Israel, particularly southern Israel? Maybe a few hours out of date, but as of yesterday evening, there had been something like 970 rockets which had fallen almost all of them deliberately in civilian areas. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, from where I sit, and from the position of several analysts, the ISIS is not really obsessing itself with Africa if you look at it more critically. Of the 8 active situations before the ICC, you know very well that 4 of those were referred to the ICC by African governments themselves. As Desmond Tutu himself has argued in October of last year during the AU summit, is that 5 times the ICC, African nations cried out for help to the ICC, and 5 times the ICC responded to those situations. Then you're aware also that in the situations of Sudan and Libya, these were Security Council referrals made to the ICC. Now, and then in the situation of Kenya, it is only where the ICC prosecutor used his own initiative to conduct investigations. Let me come back to the Security Council referrals, because I know there are always questions asked around that, and that will address the issue that Richard Dickham mentioned, the issue of double standards of justice. Of course, like Bill also pointed out, in the situation recently of Syria, there has been a tendency within some members of the Security Council to protect certain states due to interest. To address the concerns of the African Union of the uneven landscape of justice or double standards, I think that personally justice should be applied equally. When situations require intervention by the Security Council, veto powers should not be abused by members of the Security Council, but refer situations that are of grave concern around the world to the attention of the ICC. Having said that, of course, the referrals in themselves after being referred to the ICC does not mean that the ICC will automatically take them on. There's a whole legal process that the ICC goes through, and the judges can determine at some point whether to take the cases on or not. So basically, the ICC is not obsessing itself with Africa. And beyond the 8 active situations, the ICC is looking at 8 other situations. You might be aware that very recently, the ICC is considering opening investigations in the situation of Iraq. Of course, right now, it is up to the military prosecutor of the UK government to first conduct investigations, after which the ICC will come into the picture if that situation is not satisfactory. So in sum, the ICC is not obsessed itself with Africa. It is concerned with situations of grave crimes wherever they're being committed, and where the evidence leads them, they will follow them. But, of course, there's a politics of the Security Council which is completely separate from the ICC.
George, thanks very much for really having me unpack a comment I made about Palestine and Israel. Certainly, if the Palestinians were to ratify the treaty, and Bill mentioned this, and it's such an important point, and they requested the prosecutor look into events of concern to those in Ramallah, the ICC would be independently able to look at war crimes, crimes against humanity, or war crime or genocide that happened on the territory of Palestine or committed by non-Palestinians on Palestinian territory. So,
or by nationals of Palestine.
Well, that was my point. Thank you, Bill. In terms of which segues to your very real point that we have been clear about and can't be emphasized enough, that the firing of, you say, 970 rockets out of Gaza towards Israel constitutes weapon use in an indiscriminate fashion that could target civilian population, that would be a crime under the Rome Statute of the ICC. So if the Palestinian leadership made that ratification decision or accepted the authority of the ICC in this current situation, the prosecutor at that court could look into a range considered by, committed by both sides, allegedly, not just Israelis. And I think that impartiality is so important. And you rightly said in conclusion, I was using Gaza as a, you know, as a term to encompass not just Israeli strikes on Gaza, but also indeed the shooting indiscriminately of rockets aimed at Israel, which could be a crime under the Rome Statute.
Thank you, Bill. Evelyn Leopold, you mentioned that the ICC should up its game or might up its game. What did you mean by that? Secondly, on Africa, there are a fairly high number of ratifications. How many want to withdraw of that group? And on the United States, has the so-called invasion of Hague provisions been dropped, moved aside, or is gone, or what?
Well, very quickly, the Hague or the Hague invasion clauses are still there. That part of the American Service Members Protection Act have not been rescinded or waived. Mostly, it had to do with being able to provide military training and to do sell military, etc. So the best parts of the Rome Statute are still under U.S. Legal handcuffs, if you wish. But I am over time optimistic that the United States will slowly continue to move to not have this double standard that this is a court will use against others but will never allow. And these crimes in the Rome Statute are the major Geneva Conventions, the Genocide Convention. The governments decided let's have a jurisdiction over the crimes that 160, 170 of the countries in the world have ratified, and the United States has ratified most of those crimes, or most of those treaties also, so it still applies. The up its game is that I think all of the special and ad hoc tribunals and the ICC have all had difficulties in investigation, prosecutions, the length of time, et cetera. And for this to be the permanent court, it has to be much more efficient in its investigation strategies, its prosecution strategies, in how it's doing arrest, witness protection, how it's reaching out to victim communities and communicating what it's doing. It's never going to be quick, but this 8, 10, 12-year cycle that the cases are taking is unacceptable. One of the judges elected at the last assembly who is on the tribunal for Karadzic thought that the trial would be over at the Yugoslav tribunal a year later and he would move on. It's 3 years later and it's still going to be another 1 or 2 years. So this is not a new issue, but we are pleased that the new leadership at the ICC is recognizing that they need to address it. And did you want to answer the Africa issue?
Put simply, no African states want to withdraw from the Rome Statute of the ICC currently, and I'll explain why. There have been three attempts, 2009, 2011, and most recently, 2013, to withdraw from the Rome Treaty. 2009, Muammar Gaddafi, because of the indictment of Omar al-Bashir, called for a meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh and pushed African states to withdraw from the treaty. African states stood firm and refused to withdraw, including Chad threatening to withdraw from the treaty if the AU pushed them to withdraw. 2011, Mwai Kibaki was president and basically mobilized African states to withdraw because of individuals that are alleged to have committed crimes, Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto. African states at that second meeting also said no. What has to be noted before I point out the third issue is that Ruto and Kenyatta were indicted before the ICC before they were head of state and deputy president. Moving to October 2013, the issue of withdrawal was brought up, and African states said very clearly that, politics aside, when they decided to join the Rome Statute, they consulted their own parliaments and senates, and the AU should not be telling them what to do, whether they should withdraw from the Rome Treaty or not. So at present, no African states wants to withdraw from the Rome Treaty.
Yes. Could I just say a word? I'm sorry, I'll be real brief. Matthew, excuse me. Up its game, your question, Evelyn. I think we were, the three of us were at meetings last month in The Hague with over 3 days with senior court officials. And my takeaway from those meetings was very much that with the prosecutor who's been in office now 2 years, a new deputy prosecutor, and a new registrar, there are some real winds of change blowing through that building in terms of learning lessons from practices that did not work well. In particular, in regarding the prosecutor's office, doing a lot more careful investigation. So any request for arrest warrants or to confirm charges or actually be at trial itself are supported by much more thoroughgoing investigations. I think that was a major problem at the office of the prosecutor. If you look at the Fatou Bensouda's strategy for the next several years, you'll see her acknowledging that and suggesting changes she's going to implement. Now, identifying problems and suggesting policies to deal with them is different and not as hard as making the changes themselves. I think that's what we'll be watching for very carefully.
Great. Thanks a lot. Matthew Lee, Intercity Press, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access. Thanks for the briefing. I've been following this negotiation of the GA resolution on the ICC the last couple of weeks, and this issue of contacts has come up a lot, about necessary contacts or when UN officials should meet with indictees. And I know that Hervé Ladsous of UN of DPKO met with President Bashir last July, and I tried to – Ms. Bensouda said she wasn't informed in advance, the prosecutor, and I wanted to know if you can say what do you think of this issue? How – Is the UN Secretariat transparent enough? Should they – maybe they have to meet with Bashir, but should they explain what the purpose of the meeting was, something like that? And also there's an even more – there's a recent case that I wanted to ask you about, which is MONUSCO flying an FDLR leader around within the DRC. They tried to get him a travel ban waiver. It wasn't successful, but they haven't said that there was any problem with flying the head of the FDLR from Eastern Congo to Kinshasa. Today they said that he was escorted back to the east, but they didn't escort him. And I just wanted to know, is this sort of a trend of the UN, DPKO, or the Secretariat maybe being overly cavalier about their contacts with war criminals? Thank you.
Well, two quick answers on my part, and perhaps others will have. When the Security Council, under Chapter 7, takes a decision, it's doing it under the charter. It's saying that all member states of the UN need to cooperate with this peace enforcement or peacekeeping resolution. And one of our complaints has been that while the Council in 2005 referred the crimes in Darfur to the ICC, then the Council has been terrible in supporting the ICC, which conducted investigations and the judges issued indictments, et cetera, and there has been very bad cooperation. But what the Council's done, it also should say to the Secretariat, this is how you're supposed to react. Now, we still have a tremendous amount of opposition to international justice, people who think that it is not realistic, that's not how you do peace, that's not how you can do business in countries with autocratic leaders or et cetera. And the UN is no different than national governments in applying this double standard, if you wish. So we'll continue to work. Our view is that an individual has been charged with the most serious crimes in international law, then a intergovernmental official should be extremely careful in doing business with that individual, no matter what his or her position is. And that's what the non-essential contact question is. So, anyone else?
Well, Matthew. Yeah, thanks for that question. I think, yeah, it's non-essential contacts. And you don't need to be a lawyer to know putting it that way does allow latitude for contact. And there have been contacts where, you know, essential aspects of the UN mandate and lives being on the line have taken place. So I think policy needs to be interpreted very narrowly. In other words, not create many loopholes in terms of what is essential contacts. But at the same time, let's recognize there are some exceptions. I'm thinking of the experience, I think he was the former special representative of the Secretary General a few years ago, who was photographed dancing at a wedding of Omar al-Bashir's daughter, if I'm not mistaken. Now, I don't think he retained his post too much longer after that, and I don't know all the reasons for that, but I think that was a clear example of a non-essential contact, and I think the UN Secretariat handled that properly, and they should continue to do so. I don't know the particulars of the Undersecretary General for DPKO's meeting with Bashir that you were referencing. And I think that same standard applies in terms of FDLR leadership, as it should apply to Ahmed Haroon in his position as a governor of a state in southern Sudan, not South Sudan, but southern Sudan, who is accused or charged by the court for serious crimes. So, yeah, I think this policy is crucial, and it needs to be applied strictly.
Let's do one more question, I'm sorry, and then we can do some private questions.
Thank you, Bill. My name is Abadi from Le Dossier. Bill, you and I have been here for a long time, and it's good to see you. And thank you and your colleagues for this briefing. I was very interested in the statement that you made from our colleague from the Human Rights Watch, linking the Security Council to the International Criminal Court. And you said that the Security Council submits a situation to the court, not a case.
Yes.
Well, that's very interesting. A case is made out of a special situation, of a political situation. We see here the root cause of the problem is that the ICC, to a large extent, emanates from a political organ. So why are we surprised that three members of the council are not following the rules? Other members, future permanent members of the Security Council, might likely do the same. Where is the independence of justice and of the judiciary, which we are accustomed to see in a democratic framework? Thank you.
I'm sure Richard wants to answer too, but this is why we wanted to come here in the 90s and the early part before the renovations began, so that you understand. In 94, the general belief was there is no way the governments are ever going to agree to creating an international court that could bring their kings, queens, presidents, ministers, generals to an international court for justice. It just isn't going to happen. That's what we were told. 3.5 years later, a General Assembly Treaty Conference, in fact, did create this court. It is independent. The independence derived in part from the exchange that it would only apply to the nationals of the governments that ratified the treaty to their territories, and that's still the case. With this two exceptions that I mentioned at the beginning, where
the governments in the treaty recognized the Chapter 7 responsibilities and powers of the Security Council, and that, not surprisingly, has been one of the most controversial anomalies that we hope educated journalists will explain to people. And I think that, to me, it's independent to the degree that we can elect judges who will be not reporting back and getting instructions on how they're going to do judging from political sources in their countries, but who will be independent, prosecutors who will be independent, registrars that will be independent, Committee on Budget and Finance individuals that will be independent too. So the fight for independence is a constant struggle between politics and other realities. But in the statute, I think there are tremendous protections for the independence. But it is a very imperfect world that it is trying to operate in, and a very politicized world. And that, I think, is it. Richard, do you want to?
Yeah. No, good, important questions. I think Bill covered a good bit of it in terms of the independence. This court has a hell of a job to do in applying its statute fairly and evenly in all situations and to all who come before it, because it's operating in obviously such a politicized landscape. Wow! You know, the courts in New York City or the courts in Brasilia don't function in quite that kind of environment. So I think the demands are a lot tougher for this court. I think the key is that its officials apply the provisions of the treaty that created the court fairly and impartially. And if they don't, or if there's grounds to believe that they haven't, frankly, we feel it's part of our responsibility and role to call that out. Did I sound surprised by the fact that the three permanent non-state parties don't play by the rules? Well, I guess naivete, lives hard, lives on in me. I shouldn't be surprised by that. And actually, I'm not surprised by that. I think it's incumbent on them as permanent members of the Security Council, with all that entails, to give a heck of a lot more emphasis to justice and the rule of law than they do, or not just when they think it's politically convenient.
And then in finishing, I want to mention that I think you will see the coalition, global coalition, will be pushing to ask the members of the council that have the veto to refrain from using the veto for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide situations. This was also brought forward in May of 2012 by the so-called Small Five governments, who had to withdraw because of P5 pressure and other pressures. It's going to come back through a mechanism that this Swiss government is coordinating, 20-some countries, and this veto refrain issue will be coming back. And there will be a number of other issues related to the working methods, the decision-making procedures of the Security Council, and, of course, the expansion of the Council that will continue to have an impact on this. But before I leave, I wanted to say that Steve's last comment about no countries have actually refrained or have withdrawn. Oh, I just wanted to mention that this amendment that the AU summit agreed to on immunity actually is not in force. The protocol that it would be part of has not been approved by the governments in Africa. I don't think any government in Africa yet. And it is opposed in the eyes of our members in Africa, the NGOs in Africa. It's opposed to the purposes and principles
of the charter establishing the treaty or the court, and to the AU charter. And one of our Nigerian coalition, I just learned yesterday, has already sending a request to the African Court for an advisory opinion on whether that amendment was consistent with the African Union charter. So it's just because it's been decided, it isn't in effect yet. It doesn't change any of the 34 countries who have ratified the Rome Statute. They still have to not accept immunity, et cetera. So it's a long sign. We appreciate your staying this length of time. When we look forward to doing it, we will take shorter times in the future. But we enjoy having the opportunity to meet with you. So.
Adios.
Hi, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.